I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of a wonderfully fascinating book, and the title of it is The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. John Grinspan is with us. He says this is a book about growing up and going out into the public square, into wild schoolyards, flirtatious saloons, and tense polling places, about how during the loudest, most excited, least understood phase in our nation's democracy, young people played their greatest role. And the years that we're looking at, 1840 to 1900, when young people fueled American politics. John Grinspan is a historian. He's got an interesting job of American democracy, youth, and popular culture. He's a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, and he studied at UW-Madison. And we're going to learn so much and see if there are any historical comparisons. Youth vote 2016, youth vote 1848. Our phone number for you to join this history conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. And John, thank you so much for being with us. I love the book. It's just so interesting, and I just didn't know it made me remember different presidents, too. It was an interesting time in American history. But who's ever written about the American youth at this time?
Oh, thanks for having me, Kathleen. It's exciting to hear how much you enjoyed the book. And it was exciting to read this history, too.
I imagine.
To me, people know the names of some of these presidents and maybe some of these elections, but they know very little about the on-the-ground life of American democracy. And as I read these diaries of young people living in Wisconsin or upstate New York or Florida, there's just this whole political world that was really relevant to 15-year-olds that I wanted to study and understand more.
Yeah, even to 7-year-olds. One of the people who's, 7 years old, leading a group of other 7-year-olds in a torchlight midnight parade.
Yeah, they do a great job getting young people involved early, and that's why they're such great voters when they can legally vote, I think.
You start the book with Oscar Lawrence Jackson. He's 19 years old. He's a teacher, and he is in a debating society, and he's an orator. And it was amazing to think about this young person speaking before massive numbers of people on behalf of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, Oscar's a personal favorite of mine.
Is he?
What was called, yes, you know, I love that diary and I try to use it whenever I can. You feel like you know these people when
yes,
you read their intimate diaries. And he becomes a boy orator, is what they called it at the time, in the 1860 campaign, which is President Lincoln's campaign. And what happens is people notice that he's a great public speaker, and so they start calling him up before town squares and churches to speak on behalf of Abraham Lincoln in rural Ohio. And he's so magnetic and so convincing that there are these crowds of grown men and women who are gathering to hear this 19-year-old, skinny 19-year-old school teacher give speeches on slavery and union and all these important issues. And what's fascinating to me is when you read his diary, it's half about these big issues, about Abraham Lincoln and the election, and it's half about the girls he meets at rallies or getting drunk. He really mixes his social and his political life in fascinating ways.
Well, that's still true now, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting is to look at, you got a real interesting insight into what political elections were like, because you talk about, let me just read part of this. I think this is from you say to Democrats, he was impudent, foppish, immature. Soon a crew of rowdies heckling his late-night speeches, this is Oscar's speeches, drinking whiskey, hurling apples, and running their horses through the crowd. And then he's got protection around him, Oscar, the wide awakes, these young Republican men. They eyed the troublemakers and would have shot and sliced them like dogs if any one of us had been struck. Ooh.
Yeah, this is bare-knuckle politics. He wears his Bowie knife on stage and keeps a hand on it kind of as a suggestion to anyone who might attack him while he's speaking. This is 1860s, a very heated campaign in particular, but throughout 19th century politics, people are getting shot and stabbed and having bricks thrown at them. And often young people play a role in this. Children bring bricks to their older brothers to throw during campaign riots. It's not a good thing. Obviously, this isn't a golden age, but people are engaged in a way that we haven't seen since.
So did most of it come from family? Were you either a Whig or you were a Democrat or whatever you were as politics changed and parties changed during that time period because your parents were?
Exactly. There's very little independence back then. The idea that an independent voter will make up their mind when they turn 21, which was the voting age, that's not really how people do things back then. Most people vote for their party for life. And so the whole idea is if you can't change the mind of a 50-year-old voter, if he's just not going to be won over by any argument you make, you need to start young. And you convince somebody, you convince a man at 8 or 9 or 15 to support a party, or you reach out to young women so they can use their social influence to get the men in their lives, their brothers and fathers, and eventually their sons to vote for your party. So because it starts so young, because it starts in the household, it's really crucial for these parties to bring in young people.
Let's go to Susan, the 8-year-old in Florida, and her father is given a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, given to him by a guest. It was interesting how young she was that she wanted to read the book and the impact that book had on her father, and I'm wondering the impact that it had, his politics, that book, on her life.
Yeah, she's trying to figure out what adults are up to, and I think we can all empathize with. We all remember being children, and our parents are having discussions or doing things that we don't quite understand. But because politics is so central to 19th century life, often young people like Susan are trying to figure out these big, momentous issues like slavery, discussed in Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yes.
Her father gets a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin and burns it in the family fireplace. And she says, "I wanted to read that book, but it must have been an awfully bad book for father to burn it because he loved books so much." So her introduction to politics starts with this kind of act of violence almost against this important book in American history and builds out from there. Mm. So people aren't really introduced rationally to how the system works and the views of the parties. First thing she learns is there are good guys and bad guys, and she tries to understand why her parents like who they see as the good guys.
So she is 8 years old in 1855. She obviously isn't going to be able to vote during she could have voted later in her lifetime, I guess, but she spent those early years not being able to vote. What about all the young women that you write about? What was their political involvement if you couldn't vote?
You can have influence and you can have interests. And I think I don't want to exaggerate the influence of women in 19th century politics, but I think we make a mistake sometimes of saying women didn't have the vote and therefore they didn't care. It was a male sphere and only men worried about politics. When you read these diaries and letters, women and young women in particular are really fascinated and engaged because it's what their families are talking about. It's what their fathers are talking about. It's a way to reach out and court other young men in their communities. So there are all these ways other than voting to be interested and engaged in politics then and now. And women work as hard as they can to have influence and follow their interests and influence the men in their lives through whatever means they can often.
You write, adults taught children to ape their politics, sing campaign songs, and jeer the rival party. It took years of such instructions before teens could read the partisan press and even longer before young men could legally vote. But they were primed, weren't they?
Absolutely. And I think sometimes we make the mistake of thinking people are more rational than they are as voters. You know, we believe that a party stands for a certain platform, and therefore the people who support that party support that platform. But it works the other way around. People are introduced then and now to a party, and that's the good party, and then later you kind of puzzle out what that stands for, or they'll learn about a villain. You know, Andrew Jackson, for instance, was widely disliked by some Americans and beloved by others. So there are a lot of Americans who the first thing they learn is Andrew Jackson is a hero or Andrew Jackson is a villain, and they build out from there only over the years figuring out who Andrew Jackson was and what he stood for.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell that story through the eyes of William Howells, whose father was, until Jackson, whose father was a Whig until Andrew Jackson, right?
Yeah, well, a little later than that. William Dean Howells, it's funny, he was one of the most influential figures in American literature ever, really incredibly popular as a writer and as an editor in his later life. But when he was a kid, the thing he cared about most was politics. He came from this kind of poor family living in rural Ohio, and his father was one of these people who has incredibly strong political beliefs, kind of a crank, and is always talking about politics. And he supports a party, the Whig Party, that he thinks is a very good party until it endorses Zachary Taylor for president. And Zachary Taylor is a Louisiana slaveholder. His father opposes slavery, and he breaks with this party. He can't support it anymore. And this is devastating to his son, William Dean Howells, who grew up admiring the Whig Party and marching in Whig processions. He's like 8 years old, and suddenly all of his commitments are broken by his father's beliefs, and he has to figure out what's going on. Is he going to follow his father, or is he going to follow his friends and his party? And he's put in a very difficult position that he writes about for years after that.
So what does he do?
He follows his father. He is very connected to his father. He makes his father sound like a wonderful man in all of his memoirs and autobiographies. And he goes with him and becomes a supporter of a new anti-slavery party, the Free Soil Party. And it changes his politics for life. He sees himself as an adult in a way that he didn't before, because he makes this decision about what politics he's going to support.
And his father, which is incredible, gives up his livelihood. He's got a small paper, and he winds up selling his paper, his livelihood.
Yeah, and he has, I think, 7 kids. He's a wife. He has no income for them because he gives up this paper, that he just can't support this party. And the newspapers back then are incredibly popular and incredibly partisan. So there's very few papers that are independent. And the fact that he couldn't support his party's nominee meant that he was out of a job. And so it's a formative experience. It's not a question of who do you happen to support. It's so crucial to people's identity, whether they're a Whig or a Democrat or a Republican or a Free Soiler. It's formative for young people, and it's crucial for older people.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at African Americans. For much of this time period, they could not vote. For some of this period, they could vote. For a good percentage of this period, there was talk about slavery, and obviously there was a civil war. It was a momentous time in American life. George Washington Albright, his story is fascinating to me.
He's a favorite. When I started reading about him, I knew he had to make it into the book. He's a fascinating guy. His story is that he was born a slave, actually the same age exactly as Susan, who is a young woman. He's born into slavery. His mother kind of secretly teaches him how to read in Mississippi, because you couldn't teach a slave how to read. And he gets involved in politics because when he's 15 years old, it's in the midst of the Civil War, he's a slave, and Lincoln has emancipated the slaves throughout the Confederacy. But slave owners are working to keep that knowledge secret from slaves. They don't want them to find out. So George Washington Albright joins this secret political organization that sneaks out at nighttime across plantations throughout Mississippi and the South and spreads the news of emancipation. So you have this 15-year-old boy, who's not a man, kind of sneaking around, going to cabins in the middle of the night that are lit by candlelight, and whispering the news that the people in that cabin are now free, according to the federal government. And it introduces him to politics. And from there, he, throughout Reconstruction, becomes a state senator and is involved in politics for the rest of his life. This experience is a 15-year-old kind of runner for news of emancipation.
And it must have been a rather dangerous thing to do, too, wasn't it?
Oh, it's incredibly dangerous. There's incredible violence in the South during the Civil War and during Reconstruction, that people, African Americans who get involved in politics, are taking a tremendous risk. But this never really seems to stop people. There are always more young people in the 1860s and 70s who are diving into political life, even though they're putting their lives at risk at the time.
We talked about newspapers a little bit. And I'm wondering how they added to people's political knowledge and if they influenced political persuasion at all. You write that there were cheap, sarcastic, combative newspapers introducing many young people to politics. The radical New York Tribune seems to have had the greatest influence.
Yeah, newspapers are incredibly kind of punchy and aggressive during this time and incredibly widely available. People who live in frontier Nebraska or in rural Wisconsin, when they can't get anything else, can still get newspapers. And these newspapers are very partisan. They're very funny. You read a lot of sarcastic stuff in them. They really have a lot of fun kind of making fun of people. And what they do, almost like links today, is they'll cut articles from one newspaper and include it in another. So you can read one newspaper and you'll be reading about Wisconsin and New York and Florida and Virginia all at the same time. So they create this whole kind of national dialogue about politics, which is the first national dialogue we've had. The first thing people all across the country are discussing together, are arguing through the newspapers about politics.
And why was the radical New York Tribune the most influential?
That's a good question. I think it was run by a guy, Horace Greeley, who got into politics as a 29-year-old in the 1840 election, which is a very big popular election with very high turnout. The Tribune is really good at giving young people a sense that they're a part of a generational movement. He's the one who famously said, "Go West, young man." This idea that there's a generational rising, about this generation in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s, that sees America as a young nation, a growing nation with a political future, and really asks young people to get involved. It was also a publicly radical paper, an anti-slavery paper, in many ways almost bordering on a socialist paper sometimes, and it speaks to young people who really want to change the world they live in and feel like they're living in momentous times.
And how are young people spoken to about politics in their classrooms?
You know, it's funny. There's two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, if you read the primers and you read the textbooks on teaching, they don't mention politics. But if you read the diaries and the letters, they can't keep politics out. It's too loud, it's too popular, and these are one-room schoolhouses. So if you have an 8-year-old who's going to school with a 22-year-old, when the 22-year-old is excited about voting, they're going to be shouting slogans and insults and talking about the election. Suddenly the 8-year-olds and the 10-year-olds know about politics too. They kind of bring diverse Americans, young Americans together and introduce them to the politics of different parties and different ages. They're really petri dishes where people are introduced to politics.
So teachers could be influential?
Yeah. I mean, teachers are not, it's not a professional class of teachers back then who've gone to school and studied teaching. Often it's kind of young men who are wandering the country, who need a job for a couple years, and they're just as partisan as anybody else. So they talk about politics in their classrooms. And also, these are often very wild schools where the teachers have a lot of trouble controlling the kids who are throwing things, who are shouting, who are disrespectful. So often the best way to get the kids focused is to talk about the election.
That quiets everybody down, huh?
Yeah, it seems to work, apparently.
It probably wouldn't work this year, would it? If you
no, but I mean, you hear stories about kids coming into school and talking about the election today. Children are really smart, and they're paying a lot of attention, and more than I think we give them credit, and they know what's going on by 5 or 6 or 7, especially back then when they're kind of encouraged and taught to participate and have an opinion and talk politics at a young age.
Our guest this hour is John Grinspan. He's the author of The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy, Social, Politics, Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. He's found diaries of many, many young people, and they're fascinating to read, the portions that he's included in the book, from all parts of the country, taking in the issues of the day, and they were substantial, slavery being one of them. Taking in the issues of the day from listening to their parents, from their schools, from family partisan politics, from newspapers, and from rallies. And the scenes that he described are really interesting. Some of these rallies were pretty wild, and people had to be protected from one party from the other. They got to be kind of rowdy. There were also places where there were flirtations. He starts the book talking about Oscar Lawrence Jackson, this boy orator who also liked to flirt and hoped that he could find a young, pretty lady in one of the rallies in which he spoke. So there was that element in all of this as well. At any rate, the voter turnout was huge. We'll talk more about that as we continue with John. And welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I certainly grew up in a family where we talked about politics all the time and have done so all of my life. So it always astounds me when I hear that some families really don't discuss politics at the dinner table. And maybe as a result, there aren't as many young people who are engaged in politics. If you are a family that engages in politics or you don't, when you think about your life and how you became introduced to political discussions or became involved politically, if you are, and that's the crowd we want to hear from, why did you become involved politically when you were young? And why aren't a lot of people today, although there are a lot of young people, certainly Bernie Sanders attracted many of them. All right, phone lines are open. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome your phone calls for John Grinspan. The Virgin Vote is his highly entertaining, informative book, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, politics personal and voting popular in the 19th century. Let's talk a little more about the social aspect of this, John. The young Oscar Lawrence Jackson, who starts the book, is also trying to find young ladies, and I'm sure that young ladies were, according some of the young men that they met at some of these rallies, it was a social, flirtatious kind of thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Politics is the center of social life in 19th century America. There isn't football, there isn't movies, there isn't this kind of a lot of the popular culture we have today. Political life gathers people together. And in this era, it's very hard for young men and women to meet in court. They're moving around the country. This is an industrialized nation. It's a growing nation. It's a very mobile nation. It's really hard for young men and women to meet. One of the best places they can meet, especially meet strangers, is at a political rally. There aren't many other places in this culture where a proper Victorian woman can go out at midnight and flirt with strangers. But kind of under the cover of participating in the democracy, she can do that.
So did it work out? Did you find your mate that way frequently or not?
Yeah, a lot of people did. I mean, a lot of people didn't as well. But yeah, you have all these diaries of people who come home from political rallies. And first they say it was exciting and they cared about the politics. And then they write pages and pages and pages about courting. Young people, especially young women, worked really hard at courting back then and courted many partners, as many as 10 or 15.
Woo!
When they're young, really much more active than you'd expect them to be, I think. And they're mixing their politics with the rest of their social life.
And once the young men voted at the age of 21, did they stay with the same political alignment for most of their lives?
Yeah, there's a sense that you give your first vote, it's called your virgin vote, and you lose your political virginity. And there's a sense that you're supposed to be monogamous to that party after that, that if you voted for the Republicans, you stick with the Republicans. And if you voted for the Democrats, you stick with the Democrats. I mean, some people change, but most people, over 90%, stick with their first party, which is what makes these young people so valuable to politicians. They need to bring in these young people in these incredibly close elections if they want that lifelong voter on their side.
You also write about, which I find interesting, how many George Washingtons there were who were born in the country, how many other Andrew Jacksons and Henry Clay Joneses, Andrew Jackson Smiths. A lot of people were named after presidential favorites, weren't they?
Yeah, people really revere these politicians. I mean, they're also very critical of them, but people really revere certain politicians, and they'll name their children. They'll start their kids, especially their sons, from birth with partisanship. If you are an Andrew Jackson Jones, you're going to be a Democrat, probably. There's a good chance of that. And even politicians who weren't that great, even Rutherford B. Hayes. There are many, many young men named Rutherford in the 1870s during his administration. Even though he wasn't the best president, there are people who love his party, the Republican Party, and name their little newborn sons Rutherford.
I wonder if anybody last year in this country was named Rutherford.
I don't want to insult any of the Rutherfords out there. We'll have to see before I check.
Yeah, maybe we'll hear from one. All right, let's go to phone calls. Thomas in Genoa City is first caller for you. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how you doing, Kathleen?
Fine, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. You were asking about why young people get involved in politics and if it comes from the family or if it didn't come from the family, where it starts. When I grew up, my parents were Jehovah's Witnesses, so for religious reasons, they didn't get involved in politics, so I never really had exposure to it. Other than, you know, what you hear on the news and TV and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was when I was a teenager that I started listening to, it was music that started getting me more aware of politics. It was mainly punk rock music is where it started. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the topics that they talked about in that music had to do with politically motivated attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I can say that my involvement in politics progressively, you know, I've now been voting since I turned 18. And the reason I started paying attention in the first place was due to music. And I'm sure that there are probably a lot of people out there with the same kind of background.
Oh, that's interesting. And Thomas, have your politics changed, your political viewpoint over the years, or have you stayed steadfast?
I would say that my political viewpoints have changed. I remember back in high school, they administered, it was a questionnaire to kind of determine if you were liberal or conservative without really giving any indication as to what the questionnaire was about. We took it, and then I actually came out on more of the conservative side, but as I've grown up, I found myself leaning more toward the liberal side of things, the protection of civil rights and, you know, personal freedoms, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say that I think I have changed over the years. I mean, that's my perspective, but I think that I have definitely changed my perspective politically a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting reflection. I would imagine that jingles reflected, songs reflected people's political persuasions. I wonder if they influenced anybody to look at issues back in the time period you write about, John.
Oh, absolutely. I guess I should add that punk rock got me into politics, too.
No kidding. It did, really?
You know, oh, absolutely. If you're listening to the Minutemen talk about Nicaragua, you say, what is Nicaragua? Where is that place? What's going on?
So fascinating.
I think that's a lot of people's experience. And it certainly was in the 19th century. Not popular music the way we have it today, but song sheets. One of the best ways that people could get, especially young people, excited was the parties would print these song sheets that are full of all these songs, sometimes talking about how great their party is, but often kind of nasty, insulting rhymes about the other party, making fun of the appearance of the candidate on the other side, Grover Cleveland's weight or Martin Van Buren's height, kind of these personal rhymes and songs, and people all over America would sing them. You would hear these songs from Brooklyn to Wisconsin, the same kind of song. And it's interesting. It's one, because it can be printed and distributed, it's one of the first national cultures. Again, people wouldn't be singing usually the same song in Brooklyn and Milwaukee, except if the Republican Party gave them those songs, you know?
Oh, that's interesting. Was there one about Abraham Lincoln, too?
Oh, yeah, on both sides. I mean, the people who hated him called him kind of a gorilla and saw him as this, like, ignorant, backwoods kind of guy. And the people who loved him sung about how, you know, honest and rail splitter and all these kind of his kind of working class attributes. And he had an incredible sense of humor and was very connected to the humorous of the day. So he was very, very tied into the comedy scene in the 1860s.
But he had a group. Talk about these. What were they called? Wide Awake Republicans? Is that what they were called?
The Wide Awakes are a personal favorite of mine. The Wide Awakes were a movement to get Abraham Lincoln elected in the 1860 election. They're young men throughout the North and parts of the Upper South who put on these black militaristic uniforms, these kind of capes and caps, and they light torches and they march through towns at midnight in support of the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln. They're incredibly popular. There's hundreds of thousands of them around the North. People believe there might be millions of them.
Whew.
And they're very exciting to this new Republican Party that's just 6 years old and doesn't really have much of an identity yet. And they're also deeply terrifying to Southerners who think they're preparing for an invasion. I mean, they see these uniformed young men practicing military marches in Boston or in rural Illinois, and they think, oh, they're coming down to us. So they really help in a way. They play a role in precipitating the Civil War and giving the sense that this politics is permanent and it's going beyond the voting booth.
Interesting. Thanks, Thomas, so much for your interesting call. Bob in Coon Valley. Hi.
Hi. I hope this isn't too far afield of your central thesis about young people, but you've mentioned the fact that in the mid-19th century, media, newspapers were very tied to political parties. And you look at today, and at least ostensibly, media proclaim independence, that they want to be, you know, even Fox says fair and balanced and so forth. But we do kind of expect media to be independent. So I'm wondering, when did that transition either happen or start, and why? What caused the transition to an ordinary system whereby media were party platforms to media which aspires to be independent of politics?
There's a great, long, complicated story here. There's kind of a rise of this movement for independent journalism in the 1890s and around the turn of the century. Part of it is motivated by people who really want to reform America and are sick of these two parties that dominate everything and really want to investigate life and are looking at Gilded Age America and want to read more about what these kind of industrial bosses are doing and really looking deeply into how to improve their society. The flip side of the coin is that they realize there are stories that sell more papers than an election. Hmm. And they really kind of delve into the lurid side of urban America, of murders and prostitution and all these great kind of crime of the century stories. And they realize they can really sell a lot of papers with, especially with crime stories. So some people focus away from politics or away from party politics because they really want to improve society, and others because they realize it sells papers, honestly.
Well, that's interesting. Anything else, Miss Bob?
No, that's fine.
All right. Yeah, thank you. John, you were going to say something more?
I mean, I think it's often a funny mix. You see, the things that improve politics often also distract or remove public interest. That the ways people tried to improve politics or independent journalism and independent voting also often lowered voter turnout and engagement. So there's this kind of trade-off we see between the really excited, engaged politics I'm talking about in the 19th century and something a little more calm today. And, you know, you have to decide which is better.
Let's go to John in Appleton. Hello, John.
A little bit of what I was going to ask. I have a 19th century home, and doing the research on the previous owners and everything in the community and neighborhood, ran across one who was city treasurer, and reading the old county histories, was described as, staunch Democrat, and this we were hard-fought partisan elections, and for a term of 1 year, for which you can imagine how often those elections were coming around on this kind of schedule, but it's just made me think there couldn't be that many issues unless you're always assuming the other side is going to rob the treasury. But, you know, what was the motivation for that level of involvement?
Mm. Well, I guess there are a couple answers. In terms of the issues, there are these issues that people care about back then and we still care about today, about race and about immigration, and we can kind of understand how people could get heated. But sometimes they're incredibly fired up about monetary reform or tariff rules or things that we see as kind of dry but really excite people back then. So part of the story is they were politically engaged in questions we weren't that engaged in. What was the other part of the question?
Well, it was just as I say, city treasurer, there wouldn't seem to be that many issues that would be involved in a post like that.
You know, often it comes down to personality, especially in Wisconsin, especially during the frontier period. There might be two cliques in a town, a clique and the Republican clique, and they would have rivalries. Often it's tied to ethnicity. Democrats were much more likely to be people who are descended from Irish Catholic or German Catholic people, whereas kind of more Nordic types were often more supportive of the Republican Party. So sometimes there are all these complicated alliances of religion and ethnicity and class that goes into these two parties. And once you have these two parties and the city treasury is in jeopardy between the two, they really fight it out over decades.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, John, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us this hour. Our guest is John Grinspan, and he's the author of The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy, Social Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. John is a historian of American democracy, youth, and popular culture. He's curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he's a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Actually, a piece he wrote in the Times that was part of this book caught our attention, and we said, we got to talk to him and get the book, and so we did, and so we are. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The population really went from not very many people to a large number of people during these years. Huge population burst. How come?
Well, America is a very vibrant, growing nation. There are 5 million people in America in 1800 and 75 million by the end of the century. People are moving and emigrating in mass numbers from Germany and Ireland and England, smaller numbers from China, and people are still being brought over in the beginning of this period as slaves from Africa. So there are large numbers of people coming into the country. But there's also just a really large number of births, and the death rate is beginning to fall a little, so more people are living into their older years, and people are moving around a lot. So places like Wisconsin, where there are very few people living in 1800, have booming, bustling metropolis by 1900. And all this surge and change and kind of this roiling population makes people need politics more. There are a lot of unstable people in 19th century America, and the political system is one stable thing they can grab onto.
Unstable people in what sense?
In that it's very difficult to go from childhood to adulthood. People are moving around. This is a booming industrial nation where industries are being created and crumbling over a couple of years. There are depressions and panics every couple of years. It's very difficult to find that clear path, the old traditional ways of rural agricultural life, which would introduce you over time into growing up and becoming adults. They're crumbling. But there's no new system to replace them yet, the way there is in the 20th century through schools and unions and all these organizations. There are a lot of young people out there who have no idea how to become adults. And political involvement lets them feel like adults in a way that nothing else in the economy or in social life lets them do.
Let's go to Jackie in Arena next. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, Kathleen. Great show, great topic. I grew up in the United Kingdom, and I went to public school. And in our public school, we had a school council. And students could get elected by their peers to serve on the school council. So I did. And my first campaign was for girls to be allowed to have skirts that covered their knees or to wear pants in the winter, because we had to play outside unless it was raining or snowing. Since then, I helped elect Margaret Thatcher 3 times and then moved to the United States 18 years ago, where I was really shocked to be called a liberal the first time it happened to me. And then I realized I was a liberal living in a very conservative environment, and I've been actively engaged in politics since I was 11, and I'm 57, dare I admit. So I've lobbied Parliament, I've lobbied Congress since I became an American, and I think it is that we are blessed to be living in a country have established rights in the electorate, and that we can have a say, and even if sometimes we feel like our voices will never get heard, they'll never be heard if we stop voting. So I'm avid about making sure that people vote.
And I think you just inspired a few to vote. That's quite a story, John.
Absolutely. I think it's really striking that her introduction to politics was wearing pants in school.
Right.
And it does connect in a way back to what you see a lot in the 19th century, in that I think for many people, the political is personal. And the first thing that really makes them realize that governance matters in their life is something very small and intimate. Obviously, slavery had that effect for enslaved peoples. But many of the issues that get young people involved aren't these big national debates, but they're a question of, should we build a road outside of town? Or should we serve liquor on Sundays? So these kind of very small town, intimate questions that they realize kind of connect them to this larger network of politics and connect them to political life and get them voting. So I do think often we throw young people into the deep end and act as if they need to have an opinion on how to reform the banks as a first issue. Really, politics starts at home, and it starts with personal experience. And so if you can connect what kind of pants you wear to voting, I think that's the way to do it.
Thank you, Jackie, so much for your call. Great to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The book you write also asks, and you answer this in the book, how young Americans stepped further into public life as they grew older. How did they?
Well, one of the best ways they stepped into public life and politics is passing it on. We really divided the age groups less back then than we do today. There aren't age groups in most schools. Young people and kind of older young adults interact and mingle a lot in social life, in saloons, in churches, and at political rallies. And if you're a 10-year-old, you're often introduced to politics by your 20-something older sibling. So one of the things I think we could work on today is actually connecting generations more. And the one of the most important things young people do is pass down their politics to even younger people. I think that's something we need to work on more in voting today.
Who is the young person who, I can't remember his name in the book, you found his diary, whose father was able to vote after the Civil War, African-American young person, but then because of all that was happening in the South, lost his ability to vote and never voted again, and the influence that had on his son.
Yeah, that's Ned Cobb. He was a young man then. He's interviewed in the 20th century about his life as a slave. He was born, I think, after slavery, but his father was a slave. And he grew up in this weird period in which he's born into a world in which African Americans can vote and do vote in large numbers in Alabama. And by the time he's old enough to vote, the state has taken away his right to vote. And he really has the opposite progression as a lot of people. Instead of getting more and more engaged in politics, he grows up watching his father vote, and then one day he stops going to the polls. And on election day, he goes hunting or he hangs out at home, but he doesn't go and vote. And this made such an impression on this young boy in the 1880s, maybe late 1870s, that when he's interviewed in the 1960s, it's still one of the first things he talked about. So for good and for bad, politics is formative for young people, and people are paying incredible amount of attention and remember, nearly a century later, the influences over their life.
Yes. if we had only been able to work out that time in history in a much better fashion in this country, it would have saved us so much, wouldn't it?
It's absolutely true, and it's really striking when you see it on the personal level. People who fight their whole lives for the vote, and you know, even when you're reading the diaries forward, even when they have the vote, you know what's going to happen. You know how this story ends for them, and it's fascinating and striking, and it's somewhat depressing, too, to see these people who are deeply engaged in the 1868 election, and you know within a decade or two, they'll have lost that right.
Yeah. Inez in Columbus. Hi.
Hi. I was just listening to what the gentleman asked about why people were involved. My family has lived within a quarter of a mile where I live now since the 1840s. They came here before Wisconsin was actually a state. Hmm. My great-grandfather was treasurer for the township. He was on the he donated the land that became the school. And people were involved partly because they were involved. For instance, people paid their taxes, and we have the records that show it. People paid their property taxes by working on the road, by helping to build the school, by bringing wood that heated the school, that kind of thing. So people were really involved.
John.
Yeah, absolutely. Service in the military will be another. If you if you serve in the Union Army or the Confederate Army during the Civil War, that can connect you for life to politics. I think there's something going on in the 19th century that this democracy is new and it's fragile. And everyone understands that most of the nations on the planet are not democracies. They look to Europe and they see increasing autocracy over time. They see democracy as tenuous. And they see government; these governments as new. They live in places where these governments didn't exist a decade ago, that go from territories to states, for instance. And they take a real personal engagement with it. Something happens in the 20th century when your average American citizen steps back from governance and sees less personal meaning in it. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but it does correlate with this fall in voter turnout and engagement. They have a sense that government's fine and it'll be all right on its own. It's less precarious and means less to them maybe than these people in rural Wisconsin in the 1840s who really feel the need and the intimate personal connection to not only their own lives, but to proving to the world that democracy is possible and that it can work.
Thank you so much, Inez, for your call. Great history. We're learning about what happened in Wisconsin in those years. Let's talk about the voting rights. How many young people did vote? What was it regionally? Were there certain parts of the country that voted in greater numbers? But everybody voted in pretty great numbers. What are the numbers?
Oh, the turnouts are incredible. Most of these elections have average voter turnout for eligible voters, often 75-80% of eligible voters.
Something.
And in individual states, that's an average for the nation. In certain states, in Indiana, in New York, in these really contested states, especially in the lower north, turnout is over 90% in presidential election after presidential election. People are deeply engaged.
And that continues for how long, John?
60 years. There's this huge jump in the 1840 election, and for the next lifetime, basically, for 60 years, people keep turning out. Even the quietest, dullest presidential election during this period in 1852 had a much higher voter turnout than did Obama's election in 2008. They're just, turnout is much higher, and then something dramatically happens around 1900, and it crashes. And it goes from 80% of eligible voters to by the 1920s, fewer than half of eligible voters are going to the polls. There's a real dramatic change in the whole political culture from the 19th century to the 20th.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at what the anticipated vote will be for 2016, will it be, what, 60% maybe, 50%? And how will we compare, and have we compared the last couple of elections to history in the 19th century?
Well, we can't really compare to the turnouts in the 19th century. Voter turnout in the last couple of years has been, in presidential elections, better than it was in the 1990s, and certainly better than periods like the 1920s. So we're not, I think it's easy to imagine everything is getting worse every year. More people are voting than were in the 90s, and young people. Millennials are more engaged and more likely to vote in general than baby boomers or Gen Xers were. So it's not all bad news, but I don't know, historians should never predict anything, but I think a voter turnout in the mid-50s would be likely this time around.
Hmm. Let's go next to Abraham in Green Bay. Hi, Abraham.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment and also reply to an earlier caller that said the only way to get involved in politics is to vote, and say that actually in today's time, you can the best way to do it in some cases might be to not vote. And the reason I say this is I am a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I'm also a Bernie or bust. And this is seen as crazy around often, but it's not. And the reason is the Democratic Party, which, as we all know, is a private club, has made it clear that, along with the media, that the candidate that will be the nominee will not be a Bernie. And they and the party actually made this clear before even the primaries and the whole process started, where about 400 delegates announced that they will be supporting Hillary Clinton before anybody else was on the ballot, before anybody voted, before the whole election process even began back in 2015. And the reason I am a burn or bust is because it's the only option I have left, is to say, you know, if you're going to take my vote and not give me what I want, the only option I have is to say I'm not going to give you my vote at all, and you can install whoever you want.
John.
You know, this happens throughout American history. People are often unhappy, even before the primaries, often unhappy with the nominee for their party. And parties have split. The Democratic Party split in 1860 when Southerners were not happy that they didn't have a radical enough Democrat as their nominee. We see this throughout American history. We also see the opposite. The sensation we're seeing this time, surprise among Republicans that Donald Trump is the nominee. If you look, there's periods when, for instance, when William Jennings Bryan was the nominee for the Democratic Party and he was seen as a real outlier, there were shocked kind of establishment Democrats who were saying, what do we do with this guy as our nominee? I think we haven't seen any of this before. It remains a question who will turn out and who won't. Usually, most people do support their parties and do turn out in some numbers. But in close elections, a few people staying home or a few thousand people staying home can make the difference. We have elections in the 19th century, kind of the closest elections in U.S. history, that are decided by 1,000 voters here or there. So it all remains to be seen who will get engaged and who won't.
You ask a lot of questions in the book and give answers to them. We haven't talked very much, if at all, about what adult campaigners offered their young supporters in exchange for their votes.
I think the big picture best thing you can say that they offered is a sense of adulthood, that they don't really try to do what we do today, which is offer young people pop culture. They don't get celebrities to endorse them or try to connect to popular youth culture at the time. What they do is they give a sense that getting involved in politics, and Abraham is right about this in many ways other than voting, as activists on the ground, handing out leaflets and informing people, handing out ballots, also as rioters and kind of thugs, all these things make you an adult and allow you to feel as if you have play a role in the governance of your country, whether you can vote or not. And so they do a really good job offering the thing young people want most, which is a sense of maturity. They play very well to that. And it's a skill that we've lost over the last century, and I think no one really knows to this day how to best do that.
And was there a ritual that a lot of young boys who became men when they cast their virgin vote, was there a ritual they followed?
Yeah, it is kind of the chief introduction into manhood for young men at the time. It's kind of the bar mitzvah for 19th century America, that you prepare and you look forward to your first vote at age 21, because that was the voting age back then. You dress up, you grow out a beard often to try to look as mature as possible, and this is a time of great, incredible beards and mustaches and sideburns, and you go vote, and then you let everyone in your community know you vote. You hang around the polls, you maybe get a little drunk, you hassle people who look like they're going to vote from the wrong party. This is your initiation, and they really make it central to their adulthood and their citizenship.
John, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great book and a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. It's been a pleasure.
John Greenspan, and the vote is Greenspan, and the vote is the Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy, Social, Politics, Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. John has a really interesting job. He's a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He writes frequently for the New York Times, and he's a historian of American democracy, youth, and popular culture. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow we'll talk about how to get over partisanship, which seems to plague us in 2016, and we'll have an interesting first hour as well. Thanks for listening today. News is coming up momentarily.